Well, good afternoon, everyone. Lovely to see you. I realise it's the end of term and people are getting tired, but we have the honour and privilege of having the most marvellous, marvellous colleague and friend, Daniele, in the Italian Gallo, who has written this extraordinary book on direct effect. For those of you who are undergraduates and did one supervision on it, you really only scrape the surface because Daniele has produced a substantial tome in this marvelous series called, which is aimed to publish important and original studies of various branches of EU law. And that's exactly what Daniele has done. I'd rather than spend a great deal of time introducing him, because it's much more interesting to hear what he's got to say, just to say that Daniele is at Luiss University in Rome, which is the most magnificent place, a wonderful university, and he does great things there with the most wonderful relationship with his students, and no doubt he will do the same for you. So thank you very much for coming. Got about half an hour, 40 minutes, and then take some
Yeah, sure.
questions. And if you want to do it from here so that the people online can see it.
Okay. Thank you so much, Catherine, and all the colleagues and students for being here. It is a great opportunity. It is a great honor for me to debate the right effect with you all. And that will be a debate, if I'm not mistaken, Catherine, and correct me if I'm wrong. So, I look forward to hearing your comments, criticism, feedback, whatever you wish. And Catherine has been visiting Professor Luiss for a while, and has been wonderful. Students adore her, of course, and much more than they like me. So this was a bit frustrating for me, but everything worked out well. Thanks so much, Catherine, again. Okay. Yes, I will be dealing with the right effect. Good. And let me start by confirming what Catherine has been referring to. My presentation builds upon a book I wrote on the right effect in EU law, which has been published by OUP under the EU Law Library series, alongside other volumes that relate directly or indirectly to direct effects, such as Tridimas, the General Principle of EU Law, or Sacha Prechtchal's Directives, and both Lenner's EU Constitutional Law and EU Procedural Law. All these books, alongside other volumes published by Cambridge, Oxford, including the one by Catherine, of courts have been key for the writing of this monograph. So what I will do today is reflecting on the present and future of the right effect. I will thus share some thoughts on this core, yet transformative and unstable doctrine of both classical and contemporary EU law. The ultimate goal is to try at least to offer a fresh understanding of this doctrine from theoretical, doctrinal, and practical perspectives. The practical lies in me being also a practitioner and appearing before the Court of Justice and domestic courts. Okay, so in the first part of my talk, I will be digging into the right effect as a whole, so in general terms. And then in the second part, while setting out several arguments on the most contentious aspects of direct effect, I will focus on horizontal direct effect. You know anything about horizontal direct effect? Tell me yes, no? Yeah, okay. Good. Using directives as a means to explore this sophisticated, controversial, and a bit scary facet of EU law, even for fetishists of EU law like myself. So horizontal direct effect of directives is a nightmare for us, for scholars, for students, for practitioners, for judges across the 27 member states. Okay, so my starting point is that the Rett effect has evolved into a broader legal category than it was at the outset of European legal integration in the 50s and 60s. So the Rett effect is not simply what you find written in textbook, it's something more. It did evolve very much over the decades. It has done even more than other key legal principles, other key legal doctrines, because the Rett effect has never been codified in the European treaties. Okay, unlike fundamental rights, citizenship, effectiveness, effective judicial protection, not even in a declaration, as in the case of primacy. We do have a declaration on primacy. We don't have anything on the Rett effect, despite being the constitutional backbone. Constitutional backbone, core of EU law. I mean, Lennertz referred and Weiler to the Rett effect as the genius of EU law alongside 267 premier rulings procedures. So it has not been codified in the treaties precisely because the Rett effect needs to constantly evolve in order to capture and legally frame the relationships among individuals, companies, state agencies, and it needs to constantly evolve in order to capture and legally frame the broader socioeconomic transformations that occur in the society and in the market. Okay, three examples that may show you a bit what I'm telling you. You are all aware of. First example, the Rett effect has been asserted by the Court of Justice irrespective of any explicit conferral of rights upon individuals and companies. Van Gendel laws will be an example. You don't have any explicit conferral of rights in Article 30. Now this Article 30. Second example, horizontal direct effect has been granted to internal market provisions. I mean, Catherine wrote extensively a magnificent piece on that. So that even private protectionism has been brought within the scope of application of EU law, amongst many others, think of Bosman. Okay. And the third example that shows this expansive reach of the Rett effect directives. You know them very well. When sufficiently detailed, have been endowed with the Rett effect, despite the wording of Article 280 of the Treaty on the Function of the European Union, which, as we all know, seems to exclude the very direct effect of directives. Okay, being directives regarded as incomplete EU legal acts, unlike regulations. Right? But directives nowadays do produce the right effect in spite of this little interpretation of Article 288. So it seems to me that the expansive reach and potential of the Rett effect, as shown by these three examples, but there are so many examples we may come up with, stem from its two main components, from the two main components of the Rett effect. The first is the rights component. So the Rett effect is about conferral of rights. So a direct effective EU provision is the one that confers enforceable rights upon companies and individuals. It is no coincidence that the key driving force behind the Rett effect in the late 50s, early 60s was Alberto Trabucchi. You know anything about him? Do we have Italian students here? Okay, so we were discussing this with Catherine. Nowadays, Italian students still study Alberto Trabucchi, Diritto Privato, a key textbook on Diritto Privato. So Alberto Trabucchi was a judge at the Court of Justice at the time of Van Gendel laws. Okay, and then became Advocate General, first judge and then Advocate General. And so he was a private lawyer, one of the greatest private lawyers Europe has ever had. He was an academic, he was a practitioner, which means that he was mainly interested in this close relationship between the Rett effect and subjective rights. Okay, and he persuaded his fellow colleagues to embrace Van Gendel laws. So to embrace him again, the loss, and pave the way for this incredible revolution that has been then developed in the following judgments after Van Gendel's loss. Okay, this is the first component of the Red Effect. The Red Effect is about conferring rights. But then there is a second component. As this second component allowed the doctrine of the Red Effect to expand even more, that is private enforcement. So the Red Effect is not only, so to speak, about conferring rights upon individuals. The Red Effect is also about enforcing EU law, correctly enforcing EU law. So the Red Effect, by empowering individuals and companies to safeguard their EU rights, turns them into agents of EU law. Okay, this you know, through them, EU law is correctly enforced within member states. Indeed, Van Gendel's, the company, while challenging Dutch legislation, enables all other companies in similar situation to contest analogous domestic statutes. So the beauty, the strength of Van Gendel's laws is not simply about Van Gendel's laws to challenge Dutch legislation, is that through the erga omnes effect of preliminary rulings, other companies across the EU can challenge domestic statutes that infringe EU law. Well, this enforcement dimension reflects the influence of another distinctive figure at that time, Robert Lecour. Robert Lecour was judge, was a friend of Albert Trabucchi, was the French judge of the Court of Justice, then became president of the Court of Justice. He was a former politician, he was an administrative lawyer, was not a private lawyer, he was not a practitioner, so he was a grand commis d'etat. And so he was mainly interested in this enforcing element of the Red Effect. And alongside Trabucchi, he convinced some of the other judges, Van Gendel's laws is not issued by unanimity, to go for the Red Effect. Well, so in this context, taking into account these two elements of the Red Effect, rights and enforcing private enforcement, notwithstanding the inherent uncertainties of a non-written doctrine like the Red Effect, it is crucial to provide a sound legal framework for the Red Effect, at least what I hope it is. I mean, I devoted some years of my life to do so. So hopefully it is important. Why? Because this doctrine enables individuals to give practical effect to their rights, to put them into action and seek the setting aside, the disapplication, setting aside of conflict in national law, which is the most radical, you might say even proto-federal manifestation of EU law. We have Mohamed here, who is an expert on federalism. This is the most intense manifestation of EU law, no matter the realm of EU law is implicated, internal market, competition. I mean, Catherine knows this much better than I do. Fundamental rights of citizenship, there could be no effective fundamental rights protection without the Red Effect. It could be no, like, Noldo, Zambrano without the Red Effect, okay? So the result of what I'm saying is that the Red Effect is not only a legal concept, it also carries clear political connotations, as it allows national laws, which are normally enacted by national parliaments, to be challenged and replaced by EU law. The Red Effect thus questions member state sovereignty, poses a challenge to democracy itself, because there is someone challenging a law, right, passed by a national parliament, or maybe put better, repairs the collateral effect of choices that, albeit being democratic, because those laws are passed by parliaments, breach EU law. Okay, that's the strength of the Red Effect. And then the loss, the company relies on a right against the parliament that enacted that law in the Netherlands. And then the Court of Justice adopts a ruling that is binding for all other member states. Okay, so in times of sovereignties, when the Red Effect, while being a crucial tool to restore the rule of law and ensure the compliance with European treaties, it is also a contested doctrine. Okay, it was a contested doctrine at the time of Brexit, as you know better than I do. This is why in the recent position paper of the most Eurosceptic think tanks across the EU, Hungarian, German, Polish, US, direct effect, perhaps even more than primacy, has become the principal target, the main target. Think of the internal effect of the direct effect granted to Article 19 of the Treaty on the European Union. You might be familiar with this provision. That is the core of rule of law in the EU. That's alongside Article 2 on effective judicial protection, or Article 47 of the Charter. These provisions have been used by the Commission, by the Court of Justice, to challenge, for instance, Polish, Hungarian, Romanian laws. And this happened through the granting of direct effect to those provisions. Or think of what might happen should Article 2, we were discussing this with Mohamed earlier on European values, would be granted direct effect. What would be the consequence? What would be the backlashes in terms of member state sovereignty? So the very famous, inglorious, if I may, conservative US think tank, the Heritage Foundation, in a recent article, editorial on the EU, title is "The EU Seen from Washington," makes fun of the EU quite boldly, yes, quite bluntly. And while making fun of the EU, consciously or unconsciously makes fun of the direct effect, that is, of the ability for individuals to overstep member state sovereignty. Sovereignty, you know, that's the core issue nowadays. Everything is about sovereignty, I mean. Okay, and this is the background, and against this background, the idea underpinning my talk today, as well as my OUP book, is that the evolution of direct effect has not been properly acknowledged and articulated by the Court of Justice. This means that direct effect still lacks nowadays a proper framing as to its core components and consequences. So what are these contentious aspects of direct effect? These controversial aspects of direct effect, I will address them through seven interrelated arguments, relying also very much on directives. We'll see there are some other arguments in the book, but I will leave them aside. We may get back to those arguments during the debate. So the first argument, and here maybe I might get into the technicalities of direct effect. I'm sorry about that. Tell me whether it's too technical / boring or whatever, but I'll delve into that. So the first argument on this transformative and controversial doctrine. So first, my impression is that notwithstanding what we teach our students and what we find written in textbooks, the test of clarity, precision and unconditionality, the very famous test all students are familiar with, when is you provision direct effective, when it is clear, precise and conditional. Okay, so this test is no longer a cornerstone in the conceptualization and practice of direct effect. This can be inferred from the case law of the Court of Justice, where the court applies the three criteria vaguely and without consistent and steady guiding principles. This is evident above all if you look into the case law on fundamental rights. The Court of Justice tends to fully overlook that assessment. So a reference to the test is very frequently missing. The test, therefore, is not taken seriously even by the court itself. So again, we teach our students, we find everywhere, that the direct effect is about the test, but then the test is not employed by the Court of Justice many times. It's in some sectors, in some realms of EU law, the test disappears completely, okay? Even though that provision is considered by the court as directly effective, okay? Okay, The only sources of EU law for which the test continues to be applied with some frequency are directives. So why? So the reason, it seems to me, is that directives in principle should be devoid of direct effect. Thus, asserting direct effect could be considered controversial in itself. On paper, yes, but then in practice, we know that things are very different, okay? Since the presumption of the lack of direct effect of directives has largely lost the significance it once had. So nowadays, many directives, I would say most of directives, contain direct effective provisions. I will return to this point later on, where I will be delving into directives today that are designed in a way that is very much different from how they were designed years ago. Catherine delivered a wonderful speech, Lewis, on that. So second argument, clarity and precision, which actually to me, at least to me, but maybe I might be wrong, they mean the same. Clarity and precision, we tend to tell our students, you have these two premises of direct effect on top of unconditionality, clarity and precision. Well, to me, there is no difference between the two. Let's say, okay, there are these two premises. Good, the Court of Justice, when it refers to the test, sometimes referred to both clarity and precision. Well, clarity and precision, that's my understanding, are absorbed into the notion, into the premise of unconditionality. So for this reason, to me, unconditionality is the only true core element and conditio sine qua non of the test on the direct effect. What does it mean? So in other words, it's, if a norm is clear, precise, you shall not discriminate. Okay. Right? Well, that norm is not necessarily unconditional. Okay. Because you may need something else to make that norm, that provision, directly enforceable. Okay. But on the contrary, if a norm is unconditional, it is in reitsa, it is necessarily, it is automatically clear, precise. Where no further domestic measure is needed to render that EU provision enforceable, the obligation it contains by virtue of its unconditional nature must be considered clear, precise. How can you enforce an unconditional provision if that provision doesn't contain a clear, precise obligation? Okay, so this means unconditionality is the core element. Okay, just forget about clarity and precision. Unconditionality is the true element. And here comes the third argument, which rests on the second. And maybe this third argument is more interesting than the second, but the second is useful to reflect on the third. Okay, so if unconditionality means that the norm is self-sufficient because it does not require an additional act of transposition, then unconditionality equals direct applicability. Okay. Now, since direct applicability, that is to say, unconditionality, by absorbing clarity and precision is the only premise of the test of direct effect and direct applicability, albeit being considered distinct conceptually, mean the same. I mean, direct applicability, so we teach our students, direct effect is about invocability, while direct applicability is about no need to have a further act of transposition or transposing that new provision in the internal legal order. But then does it really make sense in practice? Maybe here that's, I'm biased, that's a practitioner speaking. If we consider the case law of the Court of Justice, or the case law of most Supreme Constitutional Courts, also ordinary judges, actually, in most member states, you will see that these two categories, these two concepts frequently merge. The friend is all about the test. I mean, here, there, yes. In this case, the Court of Justice discusses the test. It's one of these cases in which, you know, all case on labor rights, on non-discrimination. The Court of Justice refers to the test, but then it refers only to direct applicability, never to direct effect. So this ruling is about the test, but then the term used and the concept used is that of direct applicability. This is why, to me, what truly matters is whether a EU provision is justiciable. That is to say, whether a EU provision is applicable to the to govern the dispute at hand. So is it possible to use that EU provision to settle the dispute, to govern that that dispute at hand? If it is possible, where that provision is directly effective, which means directly applicable. From these flaws, the following consequence, which contradicts again what we find written in textbooks on Article 288. There is, to me, no meaningful difference between regulations on one end and on the other end, directly effective unimplemented directives. So this confirms the increasing convergence between these two acts. I mean, regulations are not what they were, what they used to be years ago, and directives are very much different from how they were. Okay. Nowadays, we have many regulations which are devoid of direct effect, which are devoid of direct applicability. Avocat General Rantos in Electra Bell opinion clearly shows this, that many, many regulations nowadays need something else to be directly enforced. Okay, and I think of the increase of harmonization directives. Again, Catherine wrote magnificent pieces on that. Again, the lecture you gave, another lecture you gave on Lewis on that article under 14 is the basis for many, many harmonization directives, even directives that do not aim at primarily completing the internal market. This is a very interesting topic. I will leave it aside, but very interesting topic for students. The relationship between the degree of harmonization, maximum, minimum harmonization, and of directives and their possible direct effect. Okay. So you might object. Good. Fine. What about Article 288? So there is Article 288, and this Article 288 we teach our students, and it's true, draws a line, okay, between directives and regulations. Okay. Well, first, as I had already remarked, a literal interpretation of Article 288 shouldn't allow the direct effect of directives on the whole, which is not true, because nowadays directives, in spite of Article 288, most of directives contain direct effective provisions. And secondly, just as unimplemented directives are directly applicable when they are directly effective because they contain immediately enforceable obligations, as I was saying, regulations are not always directly effective, are not always directly applicable. And really, check this opinion out by Avocat General Rantos. I mentioned earlier on, Electra Bell opinion, Rantos carries out a contra legem interpretation of Article 280 and explains to us that this is not true anymore. Regulations are very much similar to directives, and most of regulations adopted nowadays by EU institutions are not directly applicable, are not directly effective. Okay. And see also another judgment, which is called Monte-Arcosu judgment by the Court of Justice. Okay. So fourth argument, the duty to disapply, so the obligation to disapply a conflicting national law, is always the result of primacy and direct effect together, never of primacy alone. Okay. This is not the argument. It's something that the Court of Justice has clearly, for the first time, said in a ruling that is called Poplawski number 2. You might have heard of this ruling. 2018 ruling of the Court of Justice, which the Court of Justice explains that the duty to disapply is always the result of primacy and direct effect together. Okay, that disapplication is not the result only of primacy, but also of direct effect. I mean, some authors, such as Dugan, for instance, in UK, the French scholarship as a whole contended the opposite, said, well, this application is the result of primacy, and the right effect maybe there or not, but this is not really so relevant. This application is the result of primacy. The Court of Justice says this is not true. So what is the argument here? The argument is about the reasons why the duty to disapply is always the result of primacy and the right effect. The Court of Justice doesn't explain why, and this a recurring feature of the case of the Court of Justice. Sometimes the Court of Justice is minimalistic. Actually, most of the times, when at stake are foundational principles of EU law. What are the reasons then? So the first reason is straightforward. Direct effect normally generates a substitution. Okay. A replacement of national law by EU law. So direct effect shall always be there in order to trigger the disapplication of national law. Otherwise, there will be a gap, a lacuna, a legal vacuum. Okay, good. Easy. Fine. Second reason, that's to me this the most intriguing, I mean, interesting reason. So my impression is that direct effect ensures that the principle of conferral and the related principle of subsidiarity are not undermined by an unrestrained and generalized use of primacy. So justifying this application only on the basis of primacy risks, to me, upsetting the logic that governs the relationship between the EU legal order and domestic legal systems, amounting to a kind of a blank proxy or blank check to the EU. What do I mean by that? I mean that direct effect, we were discussing this with Mohamed, direct effect remains an essential doctrine. We know one that shapes the EU legal order in proto-federalist terms and makes the EU different from standard international organizations. That's also the reason why some of us at least love the EU, right? European Union law, because it's something very concrete. Okay, we love international law, very fascinating, but then let's say it's quite different from EU law. Why is EU law to me more interesting? Because it's really about positive law. That's really something that there is enforcement and the individuals are subjects of law. Okay, so good. Direct effect is a proof that EU legal order is different from international law. But then direct effect, we tend to overlook this aspect. Direct effect is also a proof that although advanced and mature and unique, the EU is not the federal union. I mean, it's not a federal state. It's something else. We need something else. We need a filter. I mean, the filter that you don't have in constitutional law, okay? So that's why direct effect, that's also why, also for this reason, direct effect is not an infant disease as Pier Pescatore defined it in a wonderful piece that dates back to the 80s. I don't remember. We need direct effect. Not only because direct effect is a proof of the originality of EU law, because also direct effect tells us that the EU is still an international organization. Okay? So fifth argument, and this is very fair. I mean, I don't know if it's really extremely technical, but it's quite complex, and I'll try to do my best to channel what I want to argue. So, so in my view, a paramount quality of direct effect alongside unconditionality. That means the right applicability, is the attribution of an advantage arising from the application of EU law and the resulting disapplication of national law. So I could return to this point later on during the discussion. The issue, which is again for fetishists of EU law, very complex issue, is that of the so-called reverse or inverse vertical direct effect. That's a nightmare. So if you want to make student fail in his head exam, just ask the student, what is reverse vertical direct effect? That's a bit weird. Okay. Yet it is very important to understand what is reverse vertical direct effect. This is a situation in which the state invokes the red effect, invokes a UDART effective provision against a company, against an individual. So you have a dispute, okay? You have a state agency invoking a direct effective provision against the private party to the dispute, okay? And in doing so, the state, what the state is doing, what the state agency is doing is aiming at getting the disapplication, obtaining the disapplication, the setting aside of the national law that the state itself has generated. Okay, you might say, yes, okay, but there is a state agency bringing a matter before the court against an individual, seeking the disapplication of a law that has been adopted by the legislator. Good, two different state agencies, but it's still the state. Okay, you know, under EU law, under international law, is one of the signs that EU law is still international law, is a state responsible. Okay. So here, basically, what you have is the state benefiting from its own failure in seeking the disapplication of its own national law to challenge the behavior of someone, of an individual, who legitimately relied on a national law that was enforced at that time. Example, because otherwise things get too blurred. Very important for Italians, seaside concessions. So seaside concessions, so you go to Sicily, Sardinia, Tuscany, whatever you want, go. So in Italy, we have these issues that we don't have so many free beaches, which is the sign of not very primitive, not very like modern advanced country, while actually you have free beaches in Spain and Greece, whatever. So if you go to the coast in Italy, you go there, fine. You want to have a glass of wine or a glass of sparkling water, whatever you choose. I go for the wine or beer, maybe. Then what happens is that since 2010, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 28, you have actually the same company running that restaurant or that cafe in that beach near Palermo. Why? Because the past government, with the exclusion of a wonderful government, we had the Draghi government, what they did was prorogating the seaside concessions, meaning that you have actually the same human being, maybe not same human being, the same company running the restaurant near Palermo since 2010. At the detriment of internal market, of free competition, we had infringing proceedings by the commission. We had ruling by the Court of Justice, in which the Court of Justice said, are you crazy, Italy? It is not possible to have this kind of prorogation because we have a free market. Why a Dutch company couldn't really run this restaurant, very trendy posh restaurant near Palermo? Okay, and even another Italian company, not possible to have this kind of prorogation. Why is it interesting, this very heated topic in Italy? I mean, first pages of Repubblica, Corriere della Sera, because you have many disputes in which the Italian Competition Authority, by relying on the direct effect of internal market provisions or even of the Bolkestone Directive, Service Directive, takes a company before a court and argues, well, there is a direct effect, there is primacy, and that prorogation is not valid, not good. Okay. So what is the problem here? The problem is that you have someone, a company, that relied on the prorogation that comes from the parliament, actually the government and then the parliament, which transposed into a law that that prorogation, they legitimately relied on that law. And so you have a direct effect that is used by the state, 5 minutes, against an individual. So there is a very serious issue. The issue is called reverse vertical direct effect. You see, vertical but reverse. It's not the individual against the state, it's the state against the individual. Okay. This is interesting because this issue and this dimension is different from horizontal direct effect. Why is different? And why, to me, reverse vertical direct effect shall be handled with utmost care, which is not the case for horizontal direct effect. Because in horizontal direct effect, you don't have the state invoking a direct effective provision. Okay? Benefiting from its own failure to seek the disapplication of its own national law. In horizontal direct effect, you have two private parties, one against the other. So you have to reach a balance of interest. So this is why it's very much different. That's why We are into different realms of the red effect. Sixth argument, it will be very, very brief on the seventh. Maybe I will even skip the seventh. Sixth argument, speaking about horizontal red effect, my sixth argument is that, at least to me, it is time to move beyond the traditional prohibition of horizontal red effect for directives, as several scholars have argued over the years. So, you know, again, we teach our students, and then, you know, directives are addressed at states. So directives cannot generate horizontal direct effect. That's what we teach our students, we find in textbooks. Well, to me, nowadays, this doesn't make, make sense anymore. It's too bold, and of course, it's too pretentious to say that. But to me, it is not really understandable anymore. There are a number of reasons why it is not understandable anymore. The first reason, which has been neglected, overlooked by scholars who reflect on directives lack of horizontality, lies in the importance of the principle of legal certainty and the legitimate expectations, which means that this principle, to me, is not relevant only from the perspective of a person who has legitimately relied on national rules contrary to an implemented directive. This principle of legitimate expectations I was speaking about also when I referred to CSI concessions is also relevant from the person who relied on a superior source of law, directive. Okay, and wants to make that EU legal source enforced correctly in national legal orders. Second reason, as the Advocate General Jacobs explained several times, Article 2088 doesn't explicitly deny that rules of directives produce horizontal red effect. Third reason, as already said, directives are different from how they were. They're published in the official journal, which means that they're accessible for private parties. They were not until it passed the treaty. Nowadays, they're published in the official journal. Most of them, they're effective. And why? Because they're often very detailed. Fourth reason relates to the lack of uniformity in the enforcement of directives devoid of horizontal red effect. And fifth reason, well, the Court of Justice case law as a whole, to me, seems to harm legal certainty. That is paradoxically the very principal reason why directives cannot, according to the Court of Justice, produce horizontal red effect. So to me, recognizing horizontal red effect of directives seems a much more coherent path than the stratagems designed by the Court of Justice to circumvent this prohibition. Think of the Mangold-Bauer legacy. You might remember directives and charter together. The very sophisticated triangular relationships legacy, the legacy on the discretion rather than the duty to disapply when the red effect is lacking. Of course, you might say, yes, okay, but this would require a terrific, dramatic twist in the jurisprudence of the Court of Justice, lacking a treaty amendment which could explicitly admit horizontal red effect. This is true, yet to me this twist is feasible given the evolution of the directives, given the evolution of your law, and given that the Court of Justice had carried out other quite dramatic twist in its jurisprudence. Seventh argument, and stop here, but just two words. To me, a big problem about the Court of Justice case law on the red effect, by extension, other principle of your law, is its argumentative minimalism. The fact that the Court of Justice, which case law, which is often quite unpredictable and inconsistent, is always minimalist in its reasoning. You might say, well, there is a technique to avoid resistance and rebellion by member states, cautiously advancing EU law. But is this really make sense? So to me, extreme judicial argumentative minimalism is as problematic as judicial activism. Okay, and so my mentor, who died a few years ago, whose name is Giuseppe Tesauro, referred in an opinion, the Bresseri opinion, in which he put forward the idea of state liability, that the Court of Justice should be audace which means bold, courage. Well, to me nowadays, the Court of Justice is not doing what it did for many years. It is not only a matter of legal certainty, it is also a matter of legitimacy, especially in times of sovereignism and Euroscepticism. Thanks so much. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much indeed for that. That's absolutely terrific and instructive and provocative questions. Mohammed, do you want to go first?
Yes, thank you so much. That's very insightful. Just a quick question on when you mentioned that the court is not using this with the charger, but he came and mentioned Bauer. But how would you even trust this was case like AMS where the court found the right horizontally, refused to horizontally evict? If I could push another question, Plovsky as well, if you can explain also your point and how this, I found really brilliant how that Plovsky too, how this is really possible that can fail. It's a very important point that I would like to hear more about.
And shall I just add the question that comes up in Tripos in various forms virtually every other year in some version, which is, should is time come to abolish the distinction between vertical and horizontal direct effect? Do any of the students want to ask any questions? I should say that's not necessarily going to be on the paper this year because we, of course, the paper hasn't been set, but so we're not giving away any secrets, but... And do you want to answer the questions from here so that they can be heard? Oh, go ahead, Mar.
Sorry, just a simple question. You mentioned that there was an Italian bill that about 288, Article
28. Yeah, sure.
Okay, then you should why the name of
okay, sure.
Okay, and thanks so much.
Do you want to come here just so that it can be recorded,
yeah,
so
sure,
that people can
sure.
So the opinion is Electra Bell, okay, you find it. It's an opinion by Advocate General Rantus, and it's a case about the electricity, if I'm not mistaken. Electra Bell sounds, yes, something related to electricity. And that's very interesting because we tend to say, you know, that's the regulations may be devoid of the right effect, okay? But we never had before this opinion by Rantos, someone, Advocate General, clearly explaining that regulations nowadays, many of them are even devoid of direct applicability, which means, again, and here I'm a bit relying on what I told you, and I will respond also partially to what Catherine was saying, that this distinction between regulations and directives, since regulations and directives nowadays are different from how they were, is really losing much of its weight. And this also means that the distinction between horizontal and vertical direct effect, which has very much to do with the difference between directives and regulation, to me doesn't make much sense, at least the way how the Court of Justice is elaborating on it. And yes, Mohammed, this is true. I mean, the Court of Justice, when it has to dwell on the right effect in order to prove a point on the horizontality of that EU provision, especially charter provision, does use the test. It is true. But then if you look into the case law on the charter, when the charter is used alongside the directives, you may have really this very inconsistent and incoherent case where the Court of Justice sometimes relies on the test, sometimes relies on only unconditionality, sometimes doesn't really even refer to the test, but then puts forward the idea that this application shall be carried out and refers to Poplaski, which, and here I close with my answers, the Court of Justice clearly tells us that this application is a result of primacy and always the red effect. And yes, in this case, this Poplawski case, I think that's very, very interesting because it the Court of Justice doesn't at all reflect on this because really shows that the red effect, what I was saying, is needed not only because we want to make EU law more unique, but also because the EU is not a federal state, it's not a federal union. So I think this is why the red effect shall always be there. If the most intense and radical consequence of the primacy is asserted by the court.
Good. I am conscious that we have people just outside. Has anyone else got any question to ask? In which case, can I thank you warmly? I mean, honestly, direct effect is something that I've been teaching for 100 years, and it's always refreshing to hear good and it's insightful insight. So thank you very much indeed.
Thanks.
And then we need to get out of here pronto.
Okay. And thanks also to those from home. Thanks. Thanks.
Hi, thanks. Thanks to you. Ciao, ciao. Thanks to you. Bye.
Should we just take the question?
Yes, sure.
People outside. Normally, they're from the bus. Apologies, sorry.
It is actually.
Okay, just sorry. One
there.
Sure, I
can. Ah, chiare delle lame, bicho. Schizzo più scandalo, un disco di in Bollywood
Park. Ah, okay, well, lei è you law, anche? Ah, ok, quindi lo sa promuovere. Sul diritto, detto del diritto privato, se lei è interessato, però mi sa che non è online. Vengo davanti dove vado a Ferrara, che è proprio su diritto contrattuale e scatti diretto in altri temi che vanno da scivola che mi danno pagato, eccetera. Se è andato da Dick Scopa, per Giovanni Dick Scopa, è interessato secondo me, vabbè, però Paolo, però non credo di essere online, oh, yeah. E
andiamo fuori. Hello.
Sì,